For me, I loosely structured my presentation around the questions that were asked, prompted to us. And so spatial method for me, in fact, came before history because it was the encounter with a city, it was the meeting with the historic architecture that even put me on the path of research. And even it was only after seeing those buildings that I started to notice that there were Russians associated with them. And so that's how I started on my journey. So in Shanghai, on the first glance, Russian-built legacy in their spaces are fairly visible. They are very large-scale buildings that are still standing. But on the other hand, if you dig deeper, there's a lot more that is still not quite visible. So part of what I do is sort of tease it out, dig it out, put it all in one place, and I use mapping for it. So this is what I'll be talking about today. So first of all, to address the question of the spatial method, I didn't read very much about it, but I've been practicing it for years. And so finally, I landed on the sort of a thought process or a definition that I liked very much, which pretty much claims that there is no history unless it is the history of places. There's nothing but space. And so I stand by that history is just the change through space. We relate everything to geography, to places, to what we see around our body. So with that, Philip Etherington's sort of on my banner, I walk forward and look at sort of cartographic and mapping methods to advance historical research. For me, this practice has always been tightly linked with visual history, identifying locations on archival photographs and imagery and drawings that I find, and place it all in relation to addresses and geographic points on the modern map of Shanghai. So from looking at a lot of historic photographs of Shanghai, one can't help but notice that there's a lot of signage, that there's a lot of Russian presence. All of that has been known before I started looking at it. But the actual density, the actual sort of prominence to all that is what I'm working on. So as one example, that I was not the first, so that even already back in the 1930s, the self-published, self-described Russian accounts of their time in Shanghai always dealt with sort of establishing their actual physical footprint. Always the photographs of the storefronts, of the factories, of the businesses that the Russian exiles owned to sort of solidify their presence. All of that went into a very nice 300-page published book published in 1936, which is now extremely rare. But it's so from that book and from a lot of other sources in which images of Russian diaspora life in Shanghai goes often uncredited, untagged, unidentified, there came a time when it was useful to put it all in geographical perspective. And so I started using the website called PassView. It's a Moscow-based Russian sort of design website, but it's got dual bilingual interface. And I'm filling the map with images that I was able to identify. There's almost 4,000 images on it now. Most of them are in public domain. Those that require sort of attribution, I do that. And so, for example, any image like this, where you see that there's a lot of Russian-owned businesses in the vicinity, but also deep inside the lane, it can all be correlated with a map and then placed next to other images that are found elsewhere. Eventually, a whole landscape reveals itself on the modern map. And then at some point, a sort of a feedback loop engages where you have already enough knowledge of what the space was like, and what the buildings were used for. And then you, it enables a pretty wonderful thing. You can then look deeper at the images and start spotting things like this little sign in the window of a Russian-run restaurant, Kavkaz. And the sign says tea dance. And so then you recall that some time ago from on a different photo, you saw an image of unidentified place that also had the tea dance in reverse in the window of it. So now we know this is what it looked like inside. So this exciting process moves me along in my inquiry. And then eventually it also allows to sort of bring in more spaces and create a real network of activities of the Russian diaspora members in Shanghai, the charities they were engaged with, the restaurants they owned, the companies they worked in, and eventually the buildings that they built, to which I'll move on in my last part of my talk. This was an example of research of buildings that don't exist anymore, but looking at the old photograph, zooming in on parts of the buildings, once again, one engages, there's a visual similarity to an existing building next door. Well, turns out this was all a complex of identical villas, part of which was demolished to redevelop already in the 1940s, but part of it still stands. So once again, this goes into the map, and when you see it in relation with other Russian Orthodox Church-owned buildings, it all makes sense because this was all very close to each other. So these examples are just to show how cartographic, geographic approach can actually just really point you in the direction that appears to be a shortcut to some new knowledge. So there we go. Once again, an example just of a page on past view where you can to show that you can not only just have an image on the map, but can also have a title, multilingual title, a little quote, a description, a link necessarily to where the image comes from to be safe, and the address in as many languages as you want, as well as orientation of the camera. So this has been very, very helpful for me, and it still is for other cities that I look at. This approach, what does this mapping method give us? For one thing, it allows you to overcome these two major obstacles that are in your way whenever you do any research about China. One is that a lot of places are actually don't look like what they used to, so they're really hard to find now. They've been redeveloped, modernized, disappeared, or made off limits to the public. Second big obstacle is that there's a pretty much this overarching secrecy whenever it comes to research, to archival research in China. A lot of documents or records are just plainly unavailable. And that goes for maybe to a great extent to researching Turkey as well, and Russia definitely for sure. So all these countries with a less sort of transparency, let's say. So we are overcoming by just being very attentive to the available documents that are stored not inside mainland China. We therefore overcome this impediment of doing archival research in China. Secondly, the interesting angle that I was very happy to embark on is that, as we all know, as historians know, that women's histories are very often told only like whenever a little negative space is left around the histories of men, right? So, or told like as a little sort of like additional side story, or told as part of family life. But of course, there was a lot more to the to women's agency, to activities of migrant women in Shanghai, specifically because they actually very often had to come to basically had to take the positions of more active family members or breadwinners for the family, take up jobs in the times when it was customary for European or non-Chinese women not to take jobs. So all of that basically also helps overcome this pervasive, very well explored angle that all diaspora women were mostly entertainers and even prostitutes. So there's so, so so much documentation in that area that one has to work extra hard to compensate for that already overflowing sea of knowledge. So one of the surprising angles to approach it could actually, once again, be maps. On the old maps, when you track all the stores with clearly with a Russian provenance, and then you correlate them with newspaper articles, with directories, with even cadastral data, with advertising, a totally different picture comes to light, actually, that the women as business owners, as active members of community in positions of professional expertise, competent, capable, sort of recognized, you know. So all that is basically just kind of helping us fill the gap and enrich complicate the picture in a good sense. Not only practicing professions, but also educating others, teaching others. So a lot of firsts in Shanghai were actually in the area of women's employment and education, professional schools, creation of whole new avenues of business. And these are just the images that I found actually in London, in London School of Economics, Women's Library, really wonderful box was just full of photographs of what Russian women did in Shanghai in the area of education. Finally, the last section and the last example of how spatial method has taken us somewhere is the fact that the Russians were not only just inhabiting the spaces or adapting them or using them, but they were actually making them in their capacity as architects, builders, contractors, engineers, and all affiliated professions. So information about this came from various places, from old maps, from city directories, from images that I purchased on eBay, and I was intrigued by the name of presumably the author of the drawing. Sometimes really attractive buildings in downtown Shanghai would have a heritage architecture plaque with a mysterious, clearly Russian sounding name written on it. So all of that fed into my investigation of the Russian built legacy in Shanghai. And so when enough information was there, I've opened the website, easy to find, Building Russian Shanghai. It's bilingual whenever it can, mostly English, but I'm working on that. And we've identified more than 70 buildings that are still standing in Shanghai, and maybe more than 100 were built at some point, but no longer with us. More than 20 architectural professional biographies are on the website. And so, for example, of the people that I was intrigued by, Levin Goldenstedt. So for him, biography now exists, and his descendants gotten in touch. Another example of this very useful feedback loop, when people can find something by searching, they will reach out for you and ask some questions, but also offer information and photographs in return. So all of this been highly sort of beneficial for me. And all the architecture drawings and plans of buildings that are not been realized as well also go there. So, you know, this way where basically there's a lot of advantages of researching this, there, I wouldn't say that there's a tremendous amount of interest or desire to basically distinguish between foreign architects among the Chinese audience. But it you know, it does a good service basically for education. It feeds into public history work, you know, the awareness of heritage. Very often at times, developers have reached out to me asking to tell more stories about certain buildings so that they could make a case for why they should not be torn down, but preserved. This is really my happiest moments. And lastly, it also does good service to the sort of traditional national history, right? That taking Russian names out of obscurity, making them basically putting them back on the, you know, hopefully back on heritage plaques in correct spelling. Basically making these names relevant once again. So this is the Building Russian Shanghai, which is derived from the work on mapping. And in conclusion, the Shanghai chapter of my life is still going on, but I'm also doing other things. And so one of them is my doctoral dissertation concerns not only Asian places of the Russian diaspora, but also European ones. And so I'm also researching, applying the same method to Berlin, Istanbul, Paris, New York, and Metro Mode's members, areas of research overlap with mine in more than one way. And specifically, I'm reading articles by every member of the team. Professor Burcu Dogramarci's, especially her work on Istanbul as an intersection point of many ways of migration, have been enlightening and put me towards the things that I've not, you know, not been yet aware of. Specifically, I would say, I would wave at Ekaterina Aygün for her great idea to identify the Russian Press Bureau in the building on Istiklal, which reminded me of the wonderful Salt Research Institute and all their photographs, and gave me once again the thought to now start putting Istanbul's old photographs on the map, especially since they are in the public access anyway. So once again, no gout introduced at the last panel was a really, was also a very sort of useful spin in the direction what